This is not a test. This is not a test. Please remain calm.
Unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Seeking human victims. Seeking human victims.
Seasons we ever did on this show, and we're probably gonna have to revisit it soon, was the Universal Monsters season, where we went through all of the classic monster movies that really provided the fabric of modern horror. We talked about Dracula and Frankenstein, the Mummy, the Wolfman, etc. And the thing that I think really made those characters so timeless was not only those amazing films that were etched into cinema history, but also the fact that they were remade many times to a lot of popularity. And the most popular remakes of these films were the British version. So what happens? Color TV comes around. They're going to remake some of the classic monsters again. So we are here on a brand new season of Seeking Human Victims to cover our first dip of our toes in the water of Hammer Horror. And this season in particular, we're talking about the vampire films, which is why we're not starting with a Quatermass film or Frankenstein. We are starting with 1958's The Horror of Dracula, starring Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing. I am your host, the devil you know, the original motherfucker, and the high priest of the coven of the goat, the Rev Dan Wilson. And I am here with my concubines of Satan, Dreamboat Annie.
Why all these garlic flowers over the window and up there? They're not for decoration, are they?
And returning to the show, always glad to have him, the Jackal of Carlsberg, Big Daddy Grizz, Jason Grizzle.
The power of the crucifix in these cases is twofold. It protects the normal human being, but reveals the vampire, or the victim of this vile contagion, when in advanced stages.
Oh, man. Longtime listeners might remember the burial plot segment that we used to do on the show, where we would kind of act out some kind of parody skits from the movie. In the form of summarizing the plot, and Grizz was often the star of that with his vocal impressions, and that wonderful Peter Cushing impression there just reminded me of that. So go back and check out some of those on the archive. And rounding out the cast, the one, the only, the great Muji.
Sleep well, Mr. Harker. Moody, hey. Often the fucking worst at doing the voices on the burial plot.
Yeah, but it was almost in so bad it's good territory at times. The Candyman episode will never be forgotten. That's all I'll say. The reason we don't do that anymore. But what a show we've got tonight. This is, it's not a modern film. It's very old film. So you got to kind of put your headspace in the old movie space. But this is a movie I've seen many, 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 many times. my personal favorite version of Dracula, so I don't know if I'm going to have any new revelations tonight, but I do have some thoughts about this film and Christopher Lee's Dracula as a whole. I probably first saw it sometime when I was in high school, like maybe middle school during AMC Fear Fest, maybe, or no, actually, I think it was on Turner Classic Movies. It was on one of the horror movie marathons at Halloween. And thinking, oh, wow, this is a different Dracula. And little did I know.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the first time I saw this. I really didn't even remember this one by name, but as soon as I started watching it, I feel like maybe I saw it on like TNT Monster Vision, like on one of those all-nighters. But maybe I'd seen it a couple of times since then, but it's been several years since I watched it, but I remembered actually way more than I thought I would.
I definitely saw this movie when I was a teenager. Just the same as you guys on cable, but a lot of it I don't remember that well because I got to admit, like back in those days, I was not super into a lot of the earlier Hammer horror stuff. As it got like a little bit further and got a little bit weirder. And also as Dracula became really obsessed with big tits, I remember those movies a little bit better just for watching for basically that purpose. But I wasn't really into Hammer. And then sometime in my 20s, I just remember me and Dan watching a bunch of Hammer horror. And that's when I really started appreciating these.
I ain't seen this shit before. I didn't know it existed.
Which is hilarious because I've watched this in the house with her like a dozen times probably.
How was I supposed to know it was a different movie? come on now.
Okay, Annie, this is that one where Dracula's after that lusty busty gal. You know that one?
Right. Like, come on. Like, I looked at the TV and didn't just assume it was a, like, come on.
And he's battling Van Helsing, played by Peter Cushing. Ring any bells? go ahead, Muji. You had a witty comment you're getting ready to throw in.
I was just going to say, Dracula's basically like, I need your blood, but I want them jugs.
Okay, well, we're going to dig on into the horror of Dracula coming up soon. But before we do that, we're going to have a musical guest, and Grizz is going to introduce him.
All right, this week we have a track from Puerto Rican death metal seers, Necro Nemesis. They return to horror paying Gore Death Productions with the new EP, Warfield Forever. Following up on the acclaimed 2021 album, Some Things Should Stay Underground, Necro Nemesis unleashed 5 blistering tracks of unforgiving death metal. Warfield Forever continues to expand the band's signature style to new levels of extremity. Prepare for sheer brutality. For fans of Belphegor, Broken Hope, Cannibal Corpse, Death, Dying Fetus, Immolation, Massacre, Mortician, Suffocation, and Vader. Here is Necro Nemesis with Whatever Comes Out This Fucking Corpse.
Ah! The coroner's report.
So how did Hammer Studios, the famous British production company, get the rights to make these monster movies? You start thinking, okay, Dracula's public domain, so they could probably just make their own Dracula movie without having to, you know, stick too closely to the original. But then you see they made a Frankenstein and a Mummy and a Wolfman and all these various movies that were pretty much remakes of the Universal films, at least in the general plot. And you find out that Hammer actually had a deal with Universal Studios. We talked a bit about this on the Universal Monster season, which once again you can access on our archives for just $1 a month over there on patreon.com/OGScare. And that will unleash 18 seasons of Seeking Human Victims for you. And we talk a lot about the Hammer-Universal relationship in that season, but it's worth bringing up again here that they do strike this deal. And so in the UK, we're going to get some Universal monster movies with blood and color, which is a whole new world that we're stepping into here. This film, directed by Terrence Fisher, written by Jimmy Sangster, was based also on the Bram Stoker novel. And it tells the story of Jonathan Harker, a young English solicitor who travels to Transylvania to close a real estate deal with the mysterious Count Dracula. However, he soon discovers that Dracula's a vampire and he's trapped in the castle as the Count's prey. His friend Dr. Van Helsing arrives to investigate his disappearance and realizes that Dracula is responsible. Van Helsing sets out to destroy Dracula and save Harker's fiance Mina from the vampire's mesmerizing clutches. So this is directed by Hammer legend Terrence Fisher, credit for revitalizing the entire gothic horror genre with films like this in the 50s and 60s. He came on the scene with The Curse of Frankenstein in 1957 with his monster movies, and then this was his follow-up in 1958. He also directed their Mummy. He directed their Sherlock Holmes Hound of the Baskervilles in 1959, as well as their Curse of the Werewolf in 1961 with Oliver Reed. His films were characterized by their dark atmosphere, graphic violence, and strong performances. He was a master of creating suspense and dread, and his films often featured iconic horror imagery. Fisher's work helped make Hammer Films one of the most successful horror studios in the world. In addition to horror, he did work in a number of other genres, including sci-fi, crime, and adventure, but it's horror that endured. And Fisher is considered to be one of the greatest horror directors of all time. And his films still live on today and are talked about on podcasts like this and a whole lot of other shit. Other movies he did, The Man Who Could Cheat Death in 1959, The Brides of Dracula from 1960, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed from 1969, The Devil Rides Out from 1968. The movie's fucking dope. The Gorgon from 1964, Lust for a Vampire from 1971, and Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell in 1974. Fisher's films have been praised by critics and audiences alike.
Do you think the Gorgon is like a really big one of the monsters from Stranger Things? Because those are demi-Gorgons.
Perhaps. I don't know what the Gorgon was. I don't think I've seen that one. I've seen most of the other ones. The music's a big part of this film. The atmosphere is really like the key thing about Hammer films. They were really bringing that gothic atmosphere with what they were called Castles and Cobwebs movies by John Carpenter. And I think that's an apt description because there's a lot of castles and a lot of cobwebs and a lot of countryside. But one of the big components of crafting that atmosphere, in my opinion, is the music. The composer was James Bernard. He was a prolific composer. who did most of these Hammer horror films. The dark and atmospheric score perfectly captures the film's mood of suspense and dread. The use of dissonant melodies and pounding rhythms create a sense of unease and foreboding. The score is very big and bombastic. It's weird because it is from that time when, like, a score still didn't go throughout most of the movie. So there's a lot of silent pieces, and the score really kind of only... The score is, you know, what they would call a Mickey Mouse score, where it's very, like, boom, 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 telling you what the big beats and moments are. But it is really cool for the atmosphere that it's trying to craft. I don't know that a different score would work.
I agree. I think the music really kicks this one up a notch. You know, it's, if you're comparing it to the Universal films, some of those, you know, at, with their age, some of the score is kind of distorted and faint. But with this, you know, maybe we just watched a nice remastering. But, you know, I think the score was perfectly clear, perfect level, and really adds to the overall picture. So thought it was a fantastic job.
The score actually was nominated for a BAFTA award for best film music and has been praised by critics and fans alike for its iconic motifs and overall quality, considered to be one of the greatest horror scores I've ever written, and very influential on a lot of other horror films and TV shows. I know, like, Dark Shadows, definitely, like, all the atmosphere from the music to the way it looks, very influenced by Hammer. Let's talk about the special effects. These were groundbreaking for the time. If I'm not mistaken, and we'll cover this in another season, because we are absolutely coming back to do the rest of the Hammer monster movies. We're starting with the vampires this season, and we're going to get through all of those because there's so many of them, or at least the majority of them. And then we're going to come back around for Frankenstein. But so, 1957, Curse of Frankenstein, the first time that blood is used in horror on screen, red blood. And so that's this huge historic thing that happens, and it changes the entire world of horror. And so this is just the follow-up movie to this. So this is like the second fucking color horror film with blood in it. And it's just wild to think about now and how kind of tame it is now. But like then, these people's minds were fucking melting. Do you understand? Their minds were fucking melting at what they were seeing on the fucking screen. And they were created by a team led by Jimmy Sangster, who was also the film's screenwriter, very talented and innovative special effects artist in his own right, came up with a number of ingenious ways to create the iconic effects. One of the most famous special effects is the scene where Dracula transforms into a bat. That was created using a combination of stop-motion animation and a matte painting. Sangster first filmed the live-action shot of Christopher Lee as Dracula. He then cut out the image of Lee and superimposed it into a matte painting of the bat flying through the night sky. The effect is surprisingly convincing and remains one of the most iconic bat transformations in horror history.
Yeah, I feel like if you told someone, like, oh, think of like an old vampire turning into a bat film clip that you've seen in your life, it's probably this one. Even like in cartoons, when they would show like vampires turning into bats, they were recreating this scene.
Yeah, that's wild to think about. Another notable special effect is the scene where Dracula's face peels away to reveal his skeletal skull. That effect is done using a thin layer of mortician's wax applied to Lee's face. When he raked his fingers across the wax, it revealed the raw marks underneath. That was so startling that it was actually cut from the original release of the film, but was restored for the 2012 Blu-ray.
Yeah, I was going to say that would have been probably way too much for a 1958 audience, but knowing they cut it for however many years, kind of makes sense. But yeah, that was pretty rough.
And of course, there's a ton of other effects. We've got the vampire bites, the blood dripping from Dracula's fangs, the smoke billowing out of his coffin. All the effects are simple but very effective and just like add to the overall feeling and vibe of the movie. Cool, groundbreaking shit. So let's talk about the cast. Probably the most memorable thing from this film. It's the second movie that really establishes Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing as an on-screen duo. They, of course, work together in The Curse of Frankenstein, where Christopher Lee plays the monster who is mute through the most of the movie, and Cushing plays Dr. Frankenstein. And in this, they're rivals, but in a much different way, as Christopher Lee, of course, plays Dracula. Christopher Lee, the legend, British actor known for this role for many, many years. But, I mean, he's a real Renaissance man. Like, what, he was in the fucking British army, or he was like a soldier of some kind. He was like a legit badass, but he was also a classic theater. Like he's just this dude who's just so multi-talented. I mean, he put out heavy metal albums in his later years. Of course, he's in Lord of the Rings and fucking Star Wars and fucking a million, zillion, trillion movies. We've covered him on the show before. I'm trying to think of what movie exactly, it's escaping me at the moment, but just the legend, one of my favorite actors, like just one of the coolest dudes ever. Unfortunately, he kind of hated the Dracula role over time and didn't really want to have much to do with it. I guess after like 10 fucking sequels or whatever, he eventually got over it. But this is the debut. He is my favorite Dracula. I love the way he can kind of switch gears from very suave and a suave, romancing, seductor type guy who's like then switches gears to just this fucking demon from hell. And like Bela Lugosi just didn't have that, you know. He was kind of the same keel throughout and great in his own right. But man, Christopher Lee, when he's got those fangs unleashed and his eyes are all bloodshot and shit, great.
Yeah, totally. Not to take anything away from Lugosi, but it's two different portrayals. But Christopher Lee, as you said, British SAS during World War II, if the stories are to be believed, trained opera singer. In fact, he thought about pursuing an opera career, but chose acting instead, and we're glad he did. Was descended from Charlemagne because his mother's Italian royalty. Let's see, 6.5 feet tall, so yeah, pretty much born to play Dracula. So yeah, he's fantastic as Dracula, and it's a shame people kind of hate the things that, you know, let us know who they are. But yeah, I can't help but think, and I'll talk more about this later, that this film was way more influential than people want to perceive, you know, because the whole time I'm watching this, and I even thought about this when watching it when I was a teenager, it's like, I think this had a huge influence on the Francis Ford Coppola movie to come later, but especially the portrayal of Dracula, you know, just the kind of night and day smooth talker, you know, nobleman into a beast. So, yeah, I thought he was fantastic in this, and I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, all the other films with him in it.
Yeah, I totally agree that Christopher Lee is my favorite Dracula as well. And he is very much more believable as kind of like the seductor than Bela Lugosi was, even though Bela Lugosi also awesome. And, yeah, it does suck that that he hates the Dracula. Like, I think that was one of the things that I've seen, you know, of course, he famously passed on playing Dr. Loomis in Halloween. And I believe that he said, like, just like, you know, being like kind of like typecast for so many years as Dracula was one of the reasons. And he also says that was like his biggest like regret on a role he passed on to. But yeah, you hate it when people kind of get bummed out with the thing that made him super famous. But, you know, he was an awesome Dracula.
And then Peter Cushing as Dr. Van Helsing. Christopher Lee's on-screen partner in many a Hammer film and otherwise. They went on to do some like Amicus movies and other shit even after this. So they were an on-screen duo for many, many, many years, decades. And of course, he played Grand Moff Tarkin in Star Wars and a number of horror roles, but this probably his most famous, also probably the most memorable Van Helsing. Now, Peter Cushing is often criticized that like he always plays the same role, but it works. He's always cast correctly. So even if he plays the same role, which is not true because there's a like vast difference between his portrayal of Frankenstein and his portrayal of Van Helsing, but also an awesome performance. Very, very direct and to the point, but I love the way he speaks. his cadence and his demeanor and everything.
Yeah, we were kind of talking about it before we started recording, but just the, you know, like you said, the cadence, and he's kind of the pinnacle of it in this movie, where he's just so, you know, he's not necessarily just reading off the script, but he's just so British and matter of fact and very believable, I think, as a 19th century doctor.
Definitely not a piss and vinegar baby face, though. Very to the point. And then we had Michael Goff as Arthur Holmwood. Goff was most famously Alfred in the 1989 Batman film, but also was in a lot of Tim Burton shit. He was in Sleepy Hollow, among other things, and considered to be one of the great British actors of his day. Still has a lasting impact on pop culture, and he was in a few of these Hammer films. And go ahead, Chris.
I just wanted to say I always enjoy a good Michael Goff performance, you know, in his old age. And then it was odd because we first saw him obviously as Alfred, but seeing him in his younger years, but he still had that same naturally dour look on his face. But yeah, you know, he had great lines like, "Is there no other way? It's so horrible."
And then we had Melissa Stribling as Mina Holmwood. Most famously known for this role, but she was in a lot of British film and television. She retired from acting in the 1960s, so didn't last long after this one. And then we had Carol Marsh as Lucy Holmwood. She was also best known for this role, also did a lot of British film and television. And then we had John Van Eisen as Jonathan Harker. He was a Dutch actor, also best known for this film. He also retired from acting in the early 60s, but he went on to be a filmmaker. It's quite an iconic and celebrated cast, and really sets the plate for Hammer horror for kind of years to come.
I was going to say, Jonathan Harker, really fucking bad plan trying to take out Dracula. Really just was like, I'm going to get into the castle, and then from there, I'm just going to figure out how to do it. Like, really.
Right.
Really should have thought stuff out just a little bit more.
Yeah, he never planned more than one step ahead of where he currently was. And no, that's
no. Hey, what's phase two?
Yeah.
He's like, I don't know what phase two is. I didn't expect to get this far.
Yeah, it's like he gets in the castle and then he's like, oh fuck, there's more than one vampire. I'm fucked. And none of my contingencies that I think maybe there would be two vampires.
Well, to be fair, in every iteration, whether it be literature, whether it be black and white, whether it be Hammer horror, whether it be fucking Francis Ford Coppola, Jonathan Harker is the fucking worst.
It's just tradition.
This is true. He is definitely the worst.
His fault, he's just written that way.
Well, you know, whether he's trying to sell him a house or kill him, he just fucks it up every time. Even selling him a house, I mean, it sells itself. You need a house in England to have it. It's like, oh, but I'm going to insult your history with the Turkish people. Oh, okay.
God damn. Shooting dates and locations. This was shot from February 11th to March 21st, 1958, at Bray Studios in Water Oakley, Berkshire, England. Some scenes were filmed on location at Black Park Country Park in Wexham, and then at Ruins of Netherley Abbey in Hampshire, England. The film's director, Terence Fisher, wanted to create a realistic and atmospheric setting for the film, so he insisted on shooting as much on location as possible. So the ruins of Netherley Abbey were particularly atmospheric, as they provided the perfect backdrop for many of the film's gothic scenes. And the crew also worked hard to create a realistic and believable vampire world.
I was a big fan of the sets in like the houses. Well, like really anytime they were inside of a house, whether it was the castle or even like the inn or whatever, everything was like very brightly colored. Like people had like blue walls and purple walls and green doors. Like one side was like this, like there was one door that was really cool. It was like two different colors on each side. And it's like, I thought it was really cool because it's like, you know, we usually only see black and white photos of, you know, these old Gothic castles unless you go there in person, which as Americans, it's hard. So it's like, you know, like it's like almost this disconnect. It's almost or like when you watch the new Rob Zombie Munsters where he filmed it and what they would have like the colors that they would have had when they filmed the black and white show. He just decided to not make it black and white. It's like weird seeing all these colors is what I'm getting at. But then you think you're like, why wouldn't they have had colors? Colors existed. So, yeah, but I did like that. It was like very Gothic, but at the same time, like almost pastel goth a little bit, which I really vibe with personally.
Pastel goth. That's interesting.
And with that odd and interesting fact, let's open the door to the auditorium.
Strange truths and morbid curiosities will be revealed inside the auditorium.
All right, dig on into these odd and interesting facts. The film was originally going to be titled Dracula, but they, even though it was like technically a licensed remake, they didn't want it to just be Dracula. So they did change it to The Horror of Dracula. So I do love the Hammer titles. They're much more interesting than just, you know, this is Dracula. No, we have Dracula has risen from the grave. Initially, Christopher Lee didn't even want to accept the role of Count Dracula, but he did. He was convinced by Terrence Fisher himself and changed his mind. Peter Cushing actually was the original Count Dracula, but he turned down the role in order to play Van Helsing instead. The blood was made from a mixture of red food coloring, corn syrup, and water, which pretty much became the traditional formula for food coloring. The vampire bites were made creating red food coloring and Vaseline. And the film smoke was created using a mixture of talcum powder and dry ice. It's a pretty standard Hammer production. They were already well into the game of making films. They had sets, they had studios, so weren't a lot of crazy, odd, and interesting facts. They already had a pretty good system in place for making movies at this point. So, you know, it was just work for these guys, but pretty interesting for the rest of us. So, let's find out how this film did, huh? Let's look at the numbers!
Numbers of the Beast. This movie was released in the UK June 16th of 58, came to the United States August 6th of 58. The budget was estimated to be £81,000. Box office worldwide, £3.8 million. So that is a hell of an investment. Made a lot of money.
Yeah, huge commercial success. Grossed over 40 times its budget. One of the most popular films at the British box office in 1958, also a success in the U.S., helped launch Hammer Films into the forefront of horror cinema in the late 50s. Universal was kind of falling off. You know, they were going into the sci-fi territory by the late 50s. They were into Abbott and Costello meets whatever Monster of the Month movies. You know, they had kind of lost steam in the pure monster movie and horror world. And Hammer sweeps right in with the 1-2 punch of Curse of Frankenstein and Horror of Dracula to become the face of that type of horror for a long time. A critical consensus on this film, also overwhelmingly positive. Praise for its atmosphere, graphic violence, and strong performances. Christopher Lee's portrayal of Dracula is considered to be definitive, as is Peter Cushing's performance as Van Helsing. The special effects are praised. The score is praised. It's just overall pretty much loved. Variety said it was a landmark in British horror. The New York Times said it was a chilling and suspenseful film. Time Out said it's a classic of the genre. Rotten Tomatoes said it's a must-see for any horror fan. And AllMovie said it's one of the greatest horror films ever made. The critical acclaim has helped make it one of the most iconic versions of Dracula in a giant pile of a lot of versions of Dracula. It leaves a legacy of many, many sequels. Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, 1968. Taste the Blood of Dracula from 1970. Scars of Dracula from 1970. Dracula AD 1972 from 1972. The Satanic Rites of Dracula from 1973. Dracula and Son from 1976. And The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires from 1974. Christopher Lee reprised the role of Dracula in all of these sequels except for the last one. And we'll talk about some of these coming up on the season. We're not going to cover all of them, but you know, we picked what we consider to be our definitive ones, and we'll have 10 total episodes for you. So stay tuned. We're back. Glad to be back for this new season. Also, big within the legacy of this is it's airing on television. This is before home video. So a lot of people did see these in the theaters and made a lot of money, as you saw. But even more than that, these were syndicated on TV. Horror of Dracula first aired on U.S. television November 14th of 1959 on the syndicated TV show Horror Theater. It's a popular episode of the show, and it helped introduce the film to a new audience. It's been aired on TV every year since then, pretty much. Remains a very popular choice for modern Halloween marathons. As we said earlier, most of us discovered it on a Halloween marathon. So, yeah, this definitely a movie I'm glad we finally got around to. So, if you want to own your own copy, you can do that. And Annie is going to tell you how.
Yes, so after it was on TV in the 50s, 1959, it was released on VHS. For the first time in the United States, February 1983, from CBS/Fox Video, and then was re-released September 1987 from Vestron, April 1990 from Universal/MCA. The Laserdisc version hit the market September 1985, so in between those VHS releases. And then a second one in April of 1991 through Universal. The DVD came along in September of 2001 through Universal with a re-release in August of 2012. The Blu-ray was also released at that time, August of 2012. And then that 2012 version is the most comprehensive home video release. It includes the full movie, of course, as well as bonus features such as audio commentary from Terrence Fisher and Christopher Lee, as well as a documentary on the making of the film and a gallery of stills and artwork, which is crazy that they had that much extra content to be able to even do. Like, I wouldn't expect them to be documenting random Hammer film in the 50s, but they did. And it's streaming on Max.
Yes, it was Max. And yeah, it kind of seems like the British were more ahead of their time than we were over here with thinking people might be interested in other shit about the movie being made besides just the movie.
Which is weird because they erased all their old TV shows when they were done with them.
Yeah, I mean, so did we. That's why a lot of the old wrestling doesn't exist anymore. Like, some of that shit's gone on forever. Because they would just tape over it with the next week's episode. Oh, how times have changed. All right. Well, that's going to do it for the Horror of Dracula. That leaves nothing but our final motherfucking thoughts. I don't have a lot more to add. I've gushed over this quite a bit. This is like a movie I just like to turn on for the vibes. Because, you know, like yeah, they are. Like, Hammer movies, here's the deal. I gotta be in a certain mood to, like, sit down and watch a Hammer movie. Like, because it is very dry. But if you're in the mood for it, like, it's quite an enjoyable experience. But I could turn these movies on in the background just to set a mood, like, any day of the fucking week. Love everything about the atmosphere, the fucking way it looks, the effects, the characters. It's just this classic piece of film. It feels very not modern and very far removed from anything digital. It feels like such a raw analog experience. And I love Christopher Lee. I love Peter Cushing. And I love this fucking dry as fuck British movie.
It is indeed British as fuck. Yeah, I mean, it's a classic British Hammer horror movie. It's Dracula. And if you like that story, you'll probably like this movie. Yep.
You, on the other hand, what did you think about it?
Yeah, they need to put Annie's review on the fucking poster. It's a Dracula movie.
It's Dracula. It's you know that guy, right? You've heard of Dracula.
It's a movie about Dracula called Dracula, starring Dracula.
Yep, and also Van Helsing, and people get hit with stakes, and I had a really hard time pulling a quote for this one because, like, most of the dialogue just sounded like what I told Dan after I watched it. I was like, I know this was like early into like horror, but like, were they not aware that they didn't have to act terrified the entire time? Like, they're just like sitting around eating a meal and they're like, ah, oh my God. And it's like, okay, chill. It's okay. Why is everybody scared the entire time? Which was like, and I mean that in an amusing way, but yeah, it was very British and it was very dry and it was about Dracula.
It is indeed all of those things. I like to think it's a little bit more. Yeah, as stated, you know, this is not a modern movie, obviously. It was here way before any of us. But I really dig this one. I thought the sets looked great. I thought the acting was fine for what it was. I thought you had some, you know, obviously we talked about Christopher Lee's performance. I enjoyed Michael Goff. You know, both of the ladies gave an adequate performance, you know, as far as British actresses go. But yeah, I think it's fun to watch now, you know, because I can see now at my age how much of an influence this had. Like I stated previously, I think this was really probably more so the vampire film and, you know, maybe the subsequent Hammer films, maybe because people were seeing more of them. I think this probably had more influence than, say, the Lugosi Dracula or, you know, any other vampire films, you know, previous. So I think this is probably more what we think of when we think of a Dracula movie. You know, it's got the great bombastic score. Dracula, like we said, you know, he's the suave, debonair nobleman who will take your luggage for you. And then he's get the bloodshot eyes and, you know, he's rampaging through the house. You know, it's not a modern film in the sense that he can also do like the spider crawl up the walls or set crosses on fire. But, you know, I thought it funny. It's like Van Helsing seizing up the top of the stairs and Dracula just shuts the door on him. And it's like, oh, no, he locked the door. I thought that was fantastic. But yeah, I really enjoyed watching this one. It makes me look forward to watching the other ones. And you know, I don't even know that it's 90 minutes. So I think it's definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, I like this movie quite a bit. It is 100% one of those movies that you kind of have to be in the mood to watch to, you know, do, you know, pay like close attention to really like enjoy. Now it can, if you are a big fan of these movies, you totally can put them on the background and, you know, just because of the fact that like so much of like what makes the movies entertaining are the atmosphere. But then, you know, like you said, the plot and stuff, you know, it's just so the dialogue and everything is so dry and the movie kind of moves so slow that's like really like pay attention to the plot and everything and understand everything that's going on. It is the type of movie that you kind of have to put on and like pay close attention to. But like I said, it is good just to put on the background for fun. The thing that I really like about these movies, and whether you enjoy them or not, I think really comes down to like if you enjoy this part of it, is that these movies, they play completely straight. Like in the Universal movies, you know, which were terrifying at first to audiences when they first came out, the earliest ones, you know, even have like a hint of camp to them, and then of course as the Universal monster movies, you know, go forward, they become campier and campier, to where by the end they were just full on camp. This is not like this. They're playing completely straight. You know, anything that's like seems like, you know, hokey or campy is just, you know, kind of a product of the fact that we're, you know, in 2023 now, and the movies just kind of aged that way. But at the time, you know, that was not. They were just, you know, going, you know, full fledged, taking it serious. And your mileage may vary with that. Like I said, if you're into it, I think you really like the movie. If you're not into it, then it can be pretty boring. But I really like it. You know, I can, you know, just see, you know, Christopher Lee on screen, you know, just doing whatever is Dracula, and that's enough to entertain me. So big thumbs up from me.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode. We'll be back next week with more Dracula. Dracula, Prince of Darkness is the film from 1966. And that will be our movie next week. Hammer gets into the swinging 60s, and we'll see how the content gets a little racier and a little weirder as things move along in this Hammer vampire season. So for all of us here at Seeking Human Victims, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
This is not a test. This is not a test. Please remain calm.
Unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims.
Seeking human victims. Seeking human victims.
The Seeking Human Victims podcast is a product of One Good Scare Productions. It is written, edited, researched, and directed by Dan Wilson, with assistance by Fuji Grant and Annie Wilson. Original music is provided by Shreddiford, as well as K.T. Grant. All other music and audio clips are property of their respective